And now we stop talking.
Yeah.
Well, now we stop talking. This is why I have to secretly hit record.
Uh-huh. I'm fine.
Because otherwise it totally fucks up the energy. And now we just stop talking despite the fact that we were having a good conversation before.
What were we talking? We're talking about your dad. We're talking about.
Dad calling us on airing stuff on the YouTube that isn't in the podcast.
Also, yeah. So, and we're trying to build up the YouTube. No, we're trying to build up the YouTube.
I remember what I was saying is I was saying that when people meet me in person, they're always surprised to discover that I'm 6 feet tall. They think I'm a lot shorter. And I think it's because I've got tiny dick energy.
Yeah.
That people meet me and they're like, oh, you're not nearly as confident as we, or your height is out of sync with your confidence. We thought you were kind of a shrimpy guy.
Why do you think that is? Why do you have tiny dick energy? Why do you think you are projecting small dick energy?
I think just some good old fashioned middle American humility is misinterpreted by the rest of the country.
They take your kindness for weakness, dick weakness.
In Oklahoma, I've got moderate dick energy. I walk into the room, people are like, that's a medium sized dick right there. And I'm fine with that. I want to be the medium.
What part of the country is the most virulent assessors of dick energy? Is that an East Coast thing, a West Coast thing, thing?
I don't know why, but immediately I went Montana. I feel like Montana, just you walk into the saloon and they're going for like guns and stuff. I don't know. I think it's a fairly universal thing.
Yeah, I would say it's East Coast.
You think?
East Coast, definitely.
Okay. Yeah.
Because there's a lot of just like,
That being said, though, like Texas has this very specific swagger to it. Like Oklahoma has a lot of overlap with Texas. We don't have the swagger. Texas has a certain kind of like throw your shoulders around thing, and it drives the rest of the country nuts. They hate it. Like,
yes,
Rick Perry could come out as a socialist and he would still be despised by all of the blue states because it's that little bit of swagger. Nobody likes that. No. You know who really hates it?
Know.
All of Europe. Europe despises Texas.
They're jealous because they ain't had that swagger since they were starting world wars.
Yeah.
You know, because they had to get that beaten out of them.
That's true. You go back to Austria circa 1915. There was some swagger.
Yeah. A level of swagger had to get settled down.
Yeah. And epaulets and a bunch of other weird things. Yeah. They were no more. We are not going to have epaulets so much anymore, at least for students in school.
Texas, it just turned into two-stepping and steel guitars.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. I went to Sagebrush. Have I taken you to Sagebrush? Have you been up to Sagebrush? I went to Sagebrush last week. It was great. Like Abby and I went two-stepping, and like you don't have to drive very far from Austin to get to Texas. It's like you just drive like 5 minutes any direction, and you're like, oh, I live in Texas. I forgot.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's not all hipsters eating half a burrito.
No, but the nice bit is that periphery bit around the edge of Austin is what America could and should be, which is. Very gay cowboys talking about guns. Like it's this nice mixture of subgroups that are melding into one another. Of you'll go there and they'll be like the farmer couple that came in and the hippie couple that came in, but they're dancing and they're having fun and everybody's friends, as America should be.
Communal dancing is something that we don't get enough of in America.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's usually some element.
Every other culture gets a communal dance. We don't really have one.
Well, I guess square dancing, two-stepping, that kind of stuff. That's communal dancing.
So like one of the things I'm jealous of my Scottish friends of is they've got Ceilidhs, which are like Scottish
the
barn
hell
dances.
Is that? Ceilidhs.
Spelled like Celia Deed or something. It's a very weird looking Celtic word. It was pronounced Ceilidh, and it's a straight up Scottish barn dance. Like I'd been to several Ceilidhs before I went to a barn dance in America. And then I went to the barn dance and like did it straight first time out the gate. I was fine. Cause I was like, oh, this is Dashing White Soldiers. Just you guys are calling it Tin Pot Hat or something, but it was the exact same dances. Cause it's Scots Irish came down through Appalachia and curved all the way into Texas. But all of the Scots, like from toddler size, go to these Ceilidhs. They'll do it for New Year's. They'll do it for weddings. They're just any big group event, they'll do a Ceilidh at. They'll do middle school dances and things. So they all kind of instinctively know how to do it. And it's not awkward. And it's a communal dance. So there's
but everyone's got to do it. Everyone's got to nut up and do it. And so it's like it forces everybody to sort of break down a little bit of their own self-importance.
Like where I grew up, and I think this is probably emblematic for the country, our dumbass dancing was in middle school, the boys and the girls would stand at separate sides terrified of each other. And then eventually you'd work up the nerve and go, do you want to dance? And then we just stand there like planks and just kind of like awkwardly looking. It wasn't even really dancing.
It was swaying.
Yeah, it was really stupid. And I'm like,
while you're getting yelled at, like your burgeoning hormones are being very, very closely guarded by your teachers.
Yeah.
Like, you're too close.
Watch your hands. Watch your hands.
So like I think like a Kaylee would have been a lot more fun for everybody. And so most cultures, I think, have some kind of common dance that is part of the society. And we don't really have one in America, even with square dancing and stuff. That's not taught in schools, is it? I don't think that like if you grew up in Texas, you know, square dancing
in California. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish we had more line dancing. And Texas doesn't like line dancing. I was so excited when I moved here to be like, I can go line dancing.
Like the hustle?
No, just like they teach you. Everyone does the same thing, but you don't have to touch any other people. You don't need a...
That's two-stepping, right?
No, you have to need a partner two-stepping.
Oh.
Yeah, and you're like spinning each other around and shit. But I like line dancing because it's just like, I can do it without my husband. Strangers are not like grinding their dicks up on me. Like it's just, I think it's fun and it's all,
you're going to the wrong two-stepping place if people are dry humping you.
Like I've never been, it's not two-stepping, but if you go like dancing in a club or whatever, like it's just boners. Yeah.
So y'all remember Kate that came over from England?
Oh, I loved her.
I took her to Broken Spoke and she was enthralled with how kind it was. She's like, all of these nice men are dancing with me and none of them are trying to hump me. And like this one guy, I told Justin about this because I was so tickled by him. It was just hunchback Ron Paul. Like imagine Ron Paul with a hunchback. It looked exactly like, and he was just this sweet old guy that was probably 85 years old that would just be like, hello, miss, would you like to dance? And then he'd take him out and spin him for a minute in a very grandfatherly way and bring him back. And that was her experience, was everybody doing that. And my suspicion is in that environment, the men are all kind of keeping tabs on each other. And that if somebody starts getting too feely, the other guys will come. That's my guess. But I didn't see any evidence that even needed to be addressed.
But I think what Jen's point of view is that the line dance, that's just an autonomous. Yeah, all you got to do is focus on your own timing relative to your neighbors. Bada bing, bang, boom. Everyone's having a good time. Your achy, breaky heart might blow up and kill this man. Like
it's
there's,
like the Cupid
that's
shuffle that you do at every wedding. Like that's basically.
You know,
I
don't know how to line dance. I've tried to learn how to do the hustle, or what was it? I think it was. I tried to learn how to do the hustle back when I used to go to a disco club, and I could never quite piece it together.
We're gonna have to find a line dancing place. I think we'll have to leave Austin, but it has to exist.
So, if in a gentocracy, you would demand line dances be taught in middle school and be done at social functions.
Well. I did have line dancing when I was a kid. Actually, I was up on the stage at Knott's Berry Farm, like helping teach line. Like, I don't even remember, but my dad used to work at Knott's Berry Farm. I think I've talked about this.
Yeah.
It's an amusement park.
He was one of the jam preserve guys.
And so for me, I used to get to go to the park whenever I wanted to. So like most kids would see line dancing and they'd be like, no, roller coasters. But I was like, I want to do this the whole time. So for like hours, I did line dancing to the point that they saw this little, I don't know, 8-year-old kid and pulled me up on stage and I knew all the dances and I was dancing with all like the tourists that came in.
God,
it was so fun.
For that dude shift, can't be anything better. Like all you have to do is try to entertain tourists or park visitors that don't give a shit about what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, a cute little 8-year-old wants to do your job for you.
Yeah.
You're like,
for the entire shift.
Nailed it. Nailed it.
Yeah,
I'm gonna get a smoke.
Me out of there.
Yeah. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
I'm Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to talk about RFK, the nominee of the Libertarian Party, as well as the last monocultural moment of our lifetime, or what quite possibly could be. That was the Super Bowl. Last Sunday, after it has rated the highest of any television program ever, and your emails. We will get into that. I have a feeling I'm going to get angry emails for this episode.
Okay. Why?
Because I'm going to very specifically needle libertarians.
Okay. All right.
All right. Yeah.
And if there's
like
one
that.
Thing that I know, oh boy, these fingers work.
Well, be nice to me or I will release you from my protection.
All right, lads. Heaton says he's beyond the law. Go for it. Let's get right into it. Hot off his retro Super Bowl ad, presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fueled speculation about a potential partnership with the Libertarian Party when he told CNN last week he and officials from the party, quote unquote, are talking. Libertarian Party Chair Angela McArdle confirmed the conversations in an interview with ABC News, but said their frequency had decreased in recent months. However, she acknowledged the former Democrat had some work to do to convince enough of Libertarian Party delegates that he sufficiently aligns with their values to earn their vote at its convention in late May, during which the party's roughly 1,000 delegates will vote on a nominee who must earn a majority of those votes. An example of what Kennedy would have to convince folks on is gun rights. McArdle called that a red line of many of her party's members. Kennedy shared little of his stance on guns in this campaign, but said last year he's, quote, not going to take people's guns away, calling it, quote, not practical, advocated for other ways to reduce gun violence besides gun control. Kennedy, of course, faces an uphill battle to get ballot access in many states, with signature deadlines in most fast approaching. Meanwhile, the Libertarian Party has ballot access in all 50 states. But for anybody who thinks that this is a possibility, the all-powerful Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party has responded thusly on X, quote, the Mises Caucus has endorsed Michael Rechtenwald for president and Clint Russell for vice president. We are working hard to see that they are nominated by our party at the Libertarian National Convention, May 23rd to 26th in D.C. We firmly oppose any strategy that would, quote unquote, rent out our party's place in any state's ballots to RFK or indeed any candidate who has so many disqualifying deviations from the essential principles of libertarianism. In fact, it was not us, but former LNC chair and strong opponent of the Mises Caucus and the Ron Paul Revolution who said that libertarians would be duty-bound to vote for the likes of Dick Cheney or even Adolf Hitler if it would secure minor party status for the LP. So, I ask you, Mr. Andrew Heaton, should the Libertarian Party rent out its nomination to RFK Jr.?
Yeah, I think they probably should, although there's lots of asterisks and caveats we can go through on here. The reason that RFK Jr., I think, is talking to the the reason the libertarians are talking to RFK Jr. is that he came out very strong on lockdowns and has been much more non-interventionist in his foreign policy application, although he's also come out very, very strongly in favor of giving Israel whatever arms or money it needs to put down Hamas. So that ship might have sailed. But initially, he came out very strong against lockdowns, and he seemed to be in a non-interventionist camp. I would suggest that the Libertarian Party would profit from having candidates that they predominantly agree with that can make a big impact. A few years ago, Mike Gravel ran as a libertarian. I don't know if you guys remember Mike Gravel.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Gravel ran as a libertarian. Mike Gravel was a very independently minded person. It's very difficult to put Mike Gravel in a box. I think he was an independent for many years. And he was a very, very pro-peace, anti-war candidate. And he rightly looked at the Libertarian Party and he went, I don't agree with everything here, but you guys have been very consistently pro-peace, very anti-war. I would love to further my pro-peace agenda. And he ran as a libertarian. I think that that's a fairly smart play. And so RFK Jr., I would be inclined to give him an airing if I were a LP delegate, which I'm not. The problem that I see structurally with the Libertarian Party that they're always going to have to deal with is something unique to the Libertarians that the Republicans and Democrats don't have, which is that the Republicans and Democrats can always have a debate over who is the platonic ideal of a Democrat or a Republican. The Republicans can get together and say, I am the true spiritual heir to Reagan because dot, dot, dot. And the other guy goes, no, you're not. You're a rhino. I'm the true Republican because dot, dot, dot. And the Democrats have come together. I'm a labor person. The heart of the Democratic Party has always been labor. No. I'm an expert in policy matters, and I represent the smart. Like, you can have those debates. With the libertarians, whoever wants less government is more libertarian. It is a much more unidirectional party in terms of application of government theory than the other parties are. And so it's much easier for the Libertarian Party to enter a purity spiral. And you want some of that because you don't want to have no principles whatsoever. But I think it would be well for them to go, look, We really agree with RFK on these things. We disagree with him on these things. But if we could get in like Justin Amash as a VP candidate, I think that that would be a very interesting ticket that could make a lot of ripples. Where I think that they've got a point in pushing back is this does happen every 4 years where there's an interesting candidate who has never previously thought or spoken to the Libertarian Party and then goes, you know what?
Notoriously welcome group. Yeah.
has never thought about it, and then goes, you know what? Maybe I'll just run as a Libertarian, and approaches them as if they will go, oh, thank God, a person to come in here. And I think where the Libertarians have something of a point is, let's say like Mark Cuban wanted to run for president, explored an independent campaign. There wasn't a lot of traction. So he went, hey, Green Party, you guys should just pick me as your running or as your candidate. Like Green Party, I, Mark Cuban, agree with you on civil liberties. And I agree
the
with
Green
you
Party,
on-
Green Party, known for loving billionaires.
Right. This is my point, is like at some point the Green Party would go, look, this would be an interesting play, but you're not an environmentalist. Right. So like I think the Libertarians have a point in being able to vet people. And for a lot of them, as Angela McArdle said in that article,
transcontinental. That, slip up.
You know what's funny is I don't know
Angela.
I don't know Angela Merkel, but I do know Angela McArdle. I've met her in California. She now lives here in Austin, Texas. I could DM her later if you want. We could find out what the status is with RFK Jr. So anyway, my point is I can see how there needs.
Can you text her right now and just say RFK question mark?
I don't have her. I don't have her phone number, but I could DM her. I think I'm friends with her husband too. If I were in it, I would give a lot of consideration to RFK Jr. But again, I do think like the other one example is last election, Eric Weinstein, who had become kind of one of the celebrated figures of the intellectual dark web, had been like, you know, we could run a centrist candidate if we just combine the ballot access of the Green Party and the Libertarian Party, and I'll let you know who we pick. And the amount of blood and sweat the Libertarian Party has to put in to actually manage to break through the gatekeepers mm-hmm. that do not, I'm going to be very clear in this, the Republican and Democratic parties care about democracy only so long as they think they're going to win it. They don't give a fuck. They care more about winning than they care about democracy, and ballot suppression is a really big thing. The Libertarians have to just absolutely sweat blood to get on the ballot every year or every 4 years. So that's synopsis. I would think it was a good idea, but there does need to be some ideological vetting, and I can appreciate that.
By the way, candidate suppression, that is part of the reason why RFK Jr. can't just get ballot access himself.
Yeah. Or here recently, the No Labels Party that we've spoken about was denied in Delaware. Why were they denied in Delaware, you ask? They were denied in Delaware because of the, and I'm picking random numbers here, but proportionally I'm accurate, of the 10,000 ballot signatures that they got out of the required 8,000 ballot signatures they got. 500 turned out to be incorrect or spelled incorrectly. Not enough to disqualify them based on the amount of ballot signatures, but the head of state of Delaware mumbled a bunch of bullshit that translates to, look, Joe Biden is from here. We're not going to have a third party candidate. Fuck you. We only believe in democracy if we think we can win it. So that is the thing.
Jen?
I don't know why this is even a conversation. It must be a slow news week because he doesn't fit the Libertarian Party at all. Just this morning, I was doom scrolling and I saw this ad that he put up about himself. I mean, and this is actually something that I like about him, where he's nervous about stuff like vaccines and chemicals in our food and our water. And, you know, so he's talking about how if he were to be president, he would want to basically sue the shit out of all these companies and do so by allowing or basically forcing these scientific journals to not be funded by these industries and therefore get real science that he can use in these lawsuits. But he's very interventionist when it comes to business. And my experience with the Libertarian Party is if you're not screaming government bad, then you don't pass their purity test. So I don't know how.
Can confirm.
Yeah. So like, how the fuck is this even a conversation? Like, he wants to use the regulatory system to, you know, regulate. He's definitely been pro-war when it comes to all the Israel stuff. He got his ass handed to him by Dave Smith, a darling of the Libertarian Party, on Dave's podcast. I think it was like a week or two ago. So what the fuck are we we even talking about? He's not a libertarian.
They're talking about it. Don't look at us.
I think your
assessment's very accurate. So I don't know RFK Jr. very well. I really only know about him as far as we've talked on this program. I've not listened to his interviews. I haven't read his stuff. But based on what I've been able to piece together, long track record of a progressive Democrat, environmentalist, vaccine skeptic. And then in the last 4 years, came out against vaccines, against lockdowns and vaccine skepticism, and then was very pugilistic with the Democratic Party. And so a lot of libertarians during that, when he popped up on the national stage, they saw him fighting with Democrats and opposing lockdowns and went, our guy. And I think, Jen, you rightly point out that, like, okay, yes, in this bandwidth right here and in this moment, you're agreeing with him. But if you start looking at all of his other positions,
as somebody reminded me, he once said that the Koch brothers should be jailed.
Yeah.
Well, probably two people who have put more money into libertarian causes.
I'm
than
pretty sure
anybody.
That one of the Kochs ran as the LP candidate about 20 years ago. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you took my angry emails, Heaton. I thought you'd be more on the Jen point of view that this was obviously not an ideological match.
Well, I mean, like, again, my thing would be like, you're if you think that he actually has a shot, if you think he could really, really push a particular candidacy, and the focal point's going to be a thing you agree with. Like, let's say, as of today, found out that he went very pro-Israel as opposed to non-interventionist. But if he were running as a super non-interventionist candidate and there were one or two other very broadly libertarian things, I could see a kind of situation of, look, we 70% agree with this guy. We 30% disagree with him. But also we're going to get in our VP and let's see what happens. There's something to be said for that, for being able to have some overlap.
Well, yeah. I mean, all right. So. Here's my argument. Number one, every candidate adjusts their views for their party platform. They adjust their views for less than that. They adjust their views because the people that are building the coalition that would put them into office have their views changing. Bernie Sanders used to be pro-gun. Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders used to be a pro
for immigration restrictionism.
Yeah. There were reasons why I think that he was ideologically consistent in the reasons why he was for those things compared to now, but his positions changed. And if he were the Democratic nominee, he would probably have slightly different positions or emphasize certain different things than other things. Do I think that you could squeeze RFK Jr. into something that is acceptable to be a libertarian candidate, especially as we look at other libertarian nominees throughout the years, like Bob Barr? And
did Gravel get on the LP presidential ticket?
Gary Johnson.
Gary Johnson. Yeah. Like, yeah, I think that you could probably do that, and you could do worse than having a Kennedy as your on the ballot to move things forward. My bigger issue with the Libertarian Party, the party of principle, is what are your principles? Not to say that they don't all have a lot of things to say, but boy, do you have vanishingly few agreement points. Do you have vanishingly few abilities where you can come together and say, all right, if RFK Jr. could say this, 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 and this, and if he said he renounced this, 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 and this, then he is somebody that we can consider. But they don't, because the Libertarian Party is not an actual party. It's not a coalition. It is a warring group of factions that don't particularly like each other. You have small L, you have big L. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that they have in common is the L. They lose constantly. They are not serious about moving forward the issues that they care about. And that's my problem with them. That is my issue with that party, is they are scared of power and they would rather sit and argue with each other than actually advance something going forward. Do I think that RFK is the best person to represent the Libertarian Party? No. I don't think that it's a great fit. I think it would be stunt casting, and you would have to make him do some level of walk of shame at their meeting. But if he were willing to do it,
like if he
should
if,
you think about
he,
it?
If he did cook bacon on a machine gun, something like that.
Well, the
If he were to come out in his gravelly ass voice and say like, I'm against driver's licenses. yeah, you should think about it. He's a fucking Kennedy.
But there's a problem in that regard too, where in the last, I'm going to say 72 hours, he announced that in order to get ballot access, it's easier to do if you have a party. So he's starting a party called We the People. So he's even saying right now that he's not going that route of trying to like kiss libertarian ass. He's starting a new thing.
Sure.
So
yeah.
There's no signs he's even into it.
Although he was in the press flirting with them openly up until a few weeks ago.
I think as of now, doesn't he only have ballot access in Utah? Isn't that the only state? So
like, and these deadlines are coming.
Yeah.
Fast. Like they are coming really, really fast in states like California and stuff like that. So, and ultimately,
I think it would make more sense to put him on No Labels because they're working on ballot access. This is a guy, he is a Kennedy. He's already famous.
I agree with that, actually. Although Labels is, while more fuzzy, Labels is going for a centrist moderate candidate. That is what they're wanting to do. I don't
know
that
I'd
call
RFK to me.
Could be. I would put RFK more in the like, wild card category of like Jesse Ventura or somebody like that who might be, but I wouldn't call Jesse Ventura a moderate.
No,
but he's like, you can't really label RFK, which is kind of the point
No Labels has always been like what they do is the last, going back to 2012, No Labels goes, we will run a third party candidate if we think the two other parties are too extreme. And their goal is to force a centrist candidate. So it's not that they're, No Labels, No Labels is the moniker, not the actual substance. The substance is centrist. We want to go towards the center.
But at the end of the day, don't you think they'd want someone that can win? Because it sounds like No Labels just, it sounds to me like No Labels would be taking on the Democrats and the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And RFK Jr., I actually think would have a chance if he could have the ballot access. Better than Joe Manchin or the other fucking names that they've been throwing around. So I just think like if we're going to have this fantasy where he joins something in order to get ballot access, it makes more sense for it to be No Labels than libertarian. Like that's all I'm saying. He doesn't.
I think that's probably true. I mean, like, again, I don't think they'd want him.
No Labels wants people with electoral experience and with governing experience.
Yeah, because they are the disenfranchised establishment party.
Yes.
Right?
We would love it if Tony Blair, Mitt Romney, and Bill Clinton would fuse into one person that we could.
Do you know
that's their idea.
Where I think he would really fit if it had ballot access is the Reform Party. I think the Reform Party is more of a odd. I mean, again, Reform Party is Jesse Ventura, right? It went Perot, Jesse Ventura, and I think that it has a little bit more wiggle room there. Whereas like the No Labels party is the centrist party or trying to be the centrist party. The libertarians are the hard, hard platonic no government or limited government party.
Yeah.
Ask him
for exactly what that means. Mm-hmm. And then wait for the next, you know, billion years as the answer continues to be calculated.
Mm-hmm. Can I unpack that a little bit? You said it's warring factions. I think that there's two broad factions that are at war in the Libertarian Party.
Oh, dude, we're going to get so many emails.
Yeah.
Only two.
I think people will broadly agree with me on the statement I'm about to make.
Mm-hmm. If you disagree, email in.
Go for it. Go for it. I think that there's two broad camps in the Libertarian Party.
Uh-huh.
And that is people that want less government and people that want absolutely no government. So the less government people,
anarchists and limited government people.
Yes. And these are very different ideological camps. Like the limited government people are Gary Johnson. They are like, and they have some overlap with old Republicans or maybe they're even Mike Gravel anti-war people, but they do want a government. They just want it to be very, very small. They're what libertarians call minarchists. And then there's the anarchists who are like, no, all government is illegitimate. All government is evil. And that's a very different ideological strain. And we're now rapidly getting out of my knowledge of the Libertarian Party. But I think the Mises Caucus is much more in the anarchist bent. And they've displaced the old minarchist kind of cozy to old executive people like Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. And that's the fight that I see going on in the Libertarian Party.
Low moral character, Bill Weld. I just would love for the Libertarian Party to care about winning on any level. And mostly because they've done all the hard parts. You're right. It's yeoman's work to stay on these ballots.
Why would you love that?
Because it's hard to do. They did the hard work. There's a lot of people that want to show up every 4 years and like a request demand access. I can understand why libertarians would look at this and say, this is insulting. You never showed up for the last 4 years. You haven't adjusted. You just, you know, you showed up on Dave Rubin's podcast 3 times. And now all of a sudden you think like, oh, I can take the easy route to ballot access. Let me come in and demand it. I get why you would feel insulted, because it does take a lot of time, effort, and organization to make sure that you stay on these ballots. And that, to me, is commendable, because it's actually playing the rules of the democracy that we have as we have it. What frustrates me is that beyond that, they cannot in any way get on the same page to actually do things that they find to be extraordinarily important. When you listen to the rhetoric of libertarian thought, it is slavery or freedom every day.
I think it's dumb. What was the Reagan quote? If I 20% disagree with you, it doesn't mean you're 20% my enemy. It means you're 80% my friend.
Yeah.
It was 80-20, the ratio he used. I know he's speaking rhetorically there. I think 80-20 is a pretty good level of consensus. If I 80% agree with you, I can work with you. The Libertarian Party oftentimes has a much higher purity threshold that makes building coalitions difficult.
Yeah.
Well, and as someone who cares more about governing than any of this campaign crap, I think we're all better off for the fact that these libertarians can't get along, because I'm just not a fan of the idea of people who are against governing being elected to do the governing. They are wrecking balls. When they get in power, they destroy things. They don't generally make things better or more efficient. So I welcome the chaos, because I don't want an anarchist running our government. Like, we have serious problems and our government can help them, and they will not be helped if the person doesn't believe in government.
I'm going to put on my minarchist hat for a minute.
Mm.
If there were a federal department of shoes and all shoes in the United States were made by the federal government, I would absolutely abolish that department. And that would not
afuera.
Be. Huh?
Afuera.
Afuera. Exist.
No, it doesn't. But my point is I want government to operate well where there should be government. If there are things that the government doesn't need to be involved in, I would get rid of it. Like the Federal Department of Education, I would probably severely reduce, not because I don't want there to be education, but because I think that that's done better at the state level. And it only goes back to Jimmy Carter.
But at this point in United States history, with $33 trillion in debt and so many of us going bankrupt or dying because of our healthcare system, and RFK has a very good point that we have stuff in our food, and I've seen for myself that we don't have nearly enough FDA inspectors to inspect what's in our drugs. And we have real problems here, and the Department of Education existing is not on the top of the list. So the fact that these people want to be elected to government to play wrecking ball because they don't like the Department of Education, that's dancing around what we actually need. We need someone who's going to go in there and start policing these giant corporations that are poisoning us. Where RFK is absolutely right.
I'm taking off my minarchist cap and I'm putting on my Heaton cap. I really like the Scandinavian model. The Scandinavian model is a higher tax, higher social safety net, dramatically lower regulatory state than the United States. So you look at Sweden, Norway, Finland, they have less government involvement in the economy. They have less regulation. In the
I heard
economy.
They were socialist.
I heard they were socialist too. As Bernie Sanders frequently brought up until the Prime Minister of Denmark flew to the United States to correct the record. I would be fine with that kind of thing. I would be fine with paying more in taxes for a better social safety net. I would in general be fine with paying more in taxes if the government worked better. I'm disinclined to pay more in taxes until we fix the government.
Well, so that's exactly what I'm saying. If you elect someone who says that they don't believe government by its nature can be effective, then you're not going to get that effective government. So I am also perfectly fine paying taxes if we have functional government. Right now, we have as dysfunctional government as I've ever seen in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So that is a problem. What we need is for our government to be functional, which means we have to elect people who believe that it's possible.
Okay, so I get you on the anarchist, on the idea that government is inherently evil, right?
Yeah.
I understand. But in terms of just limited government, are you opposed to that? If somebody's running on, that's I think not, government should be small but works well?
And as we've discussed, that's not what the Libertarian Party is. Right now, there are two factions, and there is a big chunk of them that have filled up my email inbox where it's government bad. Government is bad. You should privatize everything, the end. The fact that those two factions are in that party means that I don't want that party elected. I don't want them elected. So it's like,
well, the good news is they chaos. Agree.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So when you say that you want would like to see them try and win, I'm perfectly fine if they don't.
Sure. Yeah.
I would love for Justin Amash to
I love him.
I would love for Justin Amash to become president of the United States. Yeah. If he were running this year, and I don't think he will, but if he were, I would almost certainly vote for him. He's running for Senate in Michigan.
Senate, yeah.
So like a libertarian like that, and I think that he qualifies as a libertarian, we'll probably get some pushback, but I think broadly speaking, he would identify as a libertarian, right? Whatever Justin Amash is, I am very much in favor of.
Yeah. And he is an example of someone that I would be very open to. He was one of my favorite congressmen. So I'm not saying that like all libertarians are bad, but like what the party is right now, I have serious concerns about them taking.
I'm going to add in too, like, I think you would, and I'm sure you followed him, so you can absolutely fill in. I think you would disagree with Ron Paul on a lot domestically. I think that you would very much like Ron Paul on foreign policy.
Oh my God. I miss him in those hearings. He's one of the people that before I even started Congressional Dish, when I was just like dabbling in hearing watching, I would stop what I was doing every time he spoke because he was the one that was like reading my mind and asking the proper questions.
He was probably the most consistent American imperialism critic in the last 60 years.
Yeah.
Like he was the most vociferous, persistent critic of foreign wars, foreign adventuring, and empire building. So there are people under the libertarian label that we would both get behind.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Whew.
That cut off 10% of the emails we were about to get.
No. Not this sweet summer child. No, sweet summer child. Of course not. You kidding? Yeah. Can we get invited to the convention?
Oh, I'm sure you can.
I would love to go to
that. The Libertarian Convention?
Yeah.
We can make that happen, I'm sure.
May 23rd to the 26th.
I covered the...
We're trying to set up a live show in D.C. Maybe we should set it up for that weekend.
I've not been to the Libertarian National Convention. I have been invited before.
Get us in, Mr. Cool Guy.
I did go... When I moved to California in 2020... I moved there maybe 3 weeks before the National Libertarian. They were incredibly welcoming and nice. I interviewed all the candidates that were running at that time. I talked to Lincoln Chafee. I talked to Joe Jorgensen.
Yeah.
And everybody else that was there. They were very nice. I'm sure that they would. I genuinely think they would be very happy for all three of us to come. I don't think I even have to pull any strings.
Oh, please. You write for Reason.
I'm just telling you. I think if you email well, no, them
that's,
and say,
that's where I want.
I would love to go. I think they would go, thank you for covering us.
I want to go to that party because I'll bet you Reason will throw a party, right? It's in D.C.
For the Libertarian National Convention? I don't know.
Like, you don't know if they would?
Reason is a nonprofit educational outfit that cannot take a stance on candidates in terms of.
Sure. Can they throw a party because all their friends are in town?
Maybe. Well, this is the other thing too. We're getting beyond my knowledge here, but I get the impression that I don't think the Mises Caucus likes the Libertarian.
No, they fucking hate him
very much. So I don't know that Reason.
No, but I want everyone to be mad at me, and then I also want to go to the Reason party, and I want to party with the New Hampshire Libertarians.
Okay,
dude, let's go.
If there is a Reason party, I will get us invited to it. How about that?
I'm so in.
Just because I want to have an argument about getting licensed to use your own toaster while on 100 milligram edible. That sounds like a way to spend my late May. Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you need to go to support this show. This week, we'll be talking about replacing Joe Biden on the Democratic ticket after a special counsel said that he was a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, which is the reason why he could not get charged for willfully mishandling sensitive documents. Oh, yeah. We're doing the big topic on the Patreon because we're going to talk about Super Bowl here right now. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Super Bowl 58, broadcast by CBS on Sunday, set a record as the most watched television event in U.S. history. Preliminary Nielsen figures reported an astounding 123.4 million viewers across CBS, Univision, and various streaming platforms. The historic viewership reflects a 7% increase from last year's game, with the viewership of 115.1 million. The game's high stakes, featuring a dramatic overtime and Kansas City Chiefs consecutive win, captivated a massive audience, you know, along with Taylor Swift. Breaking down the viewership, 120 million watched live, the largest audience for a single network event. Univision also saw a record with 2.2 million viewers, the highest for a Spanish language network. I also saw that Canada had a 10 million viewership, which is gigantic. Wow. For that country, it was the highest Canadian viewership.
What is Canada's population? Like 40 million? Like, that's a lot.
That's a lot. It was a lot. The NFL's popularity, of course, has been evident throughout the season. 93 of the top 100 broadcast programs were NFL games, and the dominance in viewership allowed CBS to charge a staggering $7 million per 30-second ad, a significant increase from the $4.4 million it charged the last time it broadcast the game in 2016. The Super Bowl's advertising is an economic barometer. It's highlighting the cultural and commercial significance, as well as a sign that the viewership is at an all-time high. So, Jen, let me ask you this. We all watched the game together. Did we together witness the last moment of the monoculture in our lifetime?
I don't really know what that question means. I think I'm a dum-dum that doesn't understand what you mean by the monoculture.
So,
You remember back in the 70s when the Mary Tyler Moore show concluded and everybody in America sat down to watch the end of Mary Tyler Moore?
Or like when Cheers ended.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's monoculture. When you could go to work and anybody at work would know what you were talking about.
We all saw the same movies. We all listened to the same music because there was four radio stations. Or if you were young, you watched MTV.
So I don't think that's true. I mean, the Super Bowl is a great example of that. But at the same time, we all watch that stupid ball drop on New Year's Eve every year in Times Square. And I was in Mexico City, so I missed out on the phenomenon of the Barbenheimer double feature that seems like everyone in America, including you two, right, participated in, where everyone saw Barbie and Oppenheimer on the same day. Shit like that catches fire in the United States. We all have cookouts and do fireworks on the 4th of July. Like, I think we're not as divided as we're told. I say this all the time, but there's still things that this country does in mass.
But
the
even
Super
then,
Bowl is a really Barbenheimer, good example of it.
Barbenheimer was a meme. It certainly perpetrated into your field of view, but by the numbers, it wasn't a gigantic amount, a staggering amount of people. If you adjust for ticket inflation value, it was not as big of a thing as like The Lion King was when it first came out back in the day. There's consistently less and less people have gone to see movies. Even big record-breaking movies are adjusted for inflation, not as much as like Gone with the Wind sold, for example, when it was first in run. We have seen less and less people rate what you are just describing, a phenomenon that quote unquote everybody is involved in, that has continued to divide as we have had different ways to entertain ourselves. And I don't think that it's an insidious thing per se, or necessarily a political thing, although certainly that comes into play on some level. But rarely do we have a thing that you can expect everybody saw.
Yeah, half the country. 115 million is half the country.
Is half the country.
Wild.
I agree. It's not insidious. It's just the fact that we have a ton of media now. It's much more long tail, where if you're really into anime, you can go watch anime in a way that was a lot harder to do in 1990.
People were watching anime during the Super Bowl because they just like One Piece more than they liked Taylor Swift or Patrick Mahomes.
But I was going to say, I think that the monoculture oftentimes is illusionary, where for example, if you read how often the New York Times talked, now 10 years ago, the New York Times talked about Game of Thrones and House of Cards, you would have inferred that everyone in America was watching Game of Thrones and House of Cards. These were the two things that everyone's talking about. And like in particular groups, including mine, that is the case. When you actually looked at the stats of who was watching what, CSI Miami, way more popular.
Bigger.
Boomers.
Yeah. But that is the case though, right? So like if you're reading the New York Times, you would think everybody knows House of Cards or Game of Thrones. But in reality, like if you just go talk to random people, the likelihood that they're going to know stuff about CSI Miami is a lot higher because it had already balkanized back then. I question that was even a monoculture moment now.
That Game of Thrones?
No. The Super Bowl that we all just witnessed.
Yeah.
How many people watched that? 115 million, we think?
123.4 million viewers.
Okay. And we've got 370 million people?
Yeah, something like
okay.
that.
Okay. So my question is, that's the highest amount of people that have ever watched the game. Great.
Yeah.
Is it the highest proportion? Because if we're talking monoculture, we're talking proportion. We're not talking bulk number. So like if we go back to 1990, when we have a smaller population, was it a higher percentage of people watching? Because my guess is, yeah. My guess is that was not the highest proportion of people that's ever watched a program. That's just the amount, the largest amount, because their population's much larger. And listeners, you know that I'm sports skeptical. I had a lot of fun watching
it. You did so well.
For two reasons. One, Abby filled me in on how football works on the way over, because previously I was just mind-numbing to watch it. But she explained downs to me. That made the whole thing a lot it still was somewhat meditative. I do find football overall boring. Like when you meditate and you're focusing on your breath and then your brain starts going, should I get eggs tomorrow? And you're like, no, don't think about eggs. Think about the breath. That's how I'm like, okay, nope, focus. It's third down, three to go. Okay, so there's a certain meditative quality to it.
But don't you think it's kind of fun in between all the stuff, like you get to chat with your friends? That, like, it's a hangout.
That was what made it. That was what made it fun. Like, I loved watching our friend Eva.
Yes.
Eva got so into it. Eva would scream, God damn it, don't do this to Taylor. And then she'd throw a beer bottle at the screen. She converted three times. She kept praying to God and then would go, everyone, I'm converting to Islam. Allah, your handmaiden, your loyal handmaiden, beg you to help Kelsey throw the ball. And then at the end, when it was like the last five
Kelsey's
minutes of the game,
the ball in his
where it was, there were like 3 seconds left. And like, and she picked out, like, remember this? She had a Motorola flip phone. That's not her usual phone. And she picked it up and she just went Operation Meat Cutter. And then she broke it in half and throw it away. And she had the weirdest fucking smile I've ever seen in my life. She got really into it, right? So that was fun. I enjoyed that bit. And, yeah, and the socializing with you all.
Swifty. That's what was so cute about it. She's not really a football fan, but she wanted Taylor to win so badly.
I got into it. Remember, because I was like, if the San Francisco people win, does that mean Taylor Swift fucks their quarterback? Like, I'm rooting for the Chiefs to win just to keep this romance going.
Yeah, I think a lot of America is rooting for the end of this amazing love story arc, and America got the kiss on the floor after,
and they were
the
dancing
game,
they were literally dates dancing to the Taylor Swift song Love Story after the game,
yeah, at the win. Jason Kelce is dressed like a Mexican wrestler,
a luchador with overalls, overalls. Blasted.
Well, I think that's so,
by the way, I have an answer. 1990, 29% of the American population watched the Super Bowl. Last Sunday, 37% of the American population.
You know what? I lay down my arms in terms of my monoculture argument. Perhaps that was the last monoculture moment.
Well, the argument would be that we will be less interested in it, which I guess
not if Taylor Swift's involved. I think she's a media genius. Like,
can you do it twice?
Yes.
Or do we need another pop star?
She is a genius. Like, 3 weeks ago on the Patreon, we talked about Taylor Swift and there was debate as to whether she'd make it from Japan or not. Why did we talk about that? Because she's a genius and she implanted that in the subconscious mind of America. She had her agents, her secret KGB Swift agents.
So wait a minute, hold on.
Disseminate out into the media body.
So you're on the PSYOP train.
Oh,
You're just saying she's not a puppet. She's the puppeteer.
No. She is the puppeteer. Taylor Swift.
Not the CIA.
If she wanted to be a psyop, she could get the fucking CIA to slit their throats and put her in. She's fucking brilliant at media. She is the best earned media attention of our generation. And she planted that. I don't know if Taylor's going to be. She's really worried if she's going to. That way everyone in America debated. Is she going to make it? She was going to fucking make it back from the get-go.
She was never worried about it. No. She said it'll be fine.
But she had all of her people go out. This is what they regularly do. They're brilliant. So I'm never going to bet against Taylor Swift drawing a crowd. I'm always going to think she's going to draw a crowd. She's going to be 70 years old and it's going to be,
betting on this relationship staying together.
Oh no.
And the Chiefs making the Super Bowl again.
Again, what I think is going to happen is they're not going to stay together. I think Harry and the Duchess are going to break up and she's going to date Harry. That's what I think is going to happen. I think that it is going to be you're like, the stock can't go any higher. How could the stock go higher? And yet it gets higher. That's Taylor Swift with earned media attention. She's brilliant. So she's going to keep going up. When she's like 80, she's going to go, I feel great. I can't wait to do this concert. And all of her minions are going to go out and go, she's been having heart palpitations. They're really afraid she's going to die. They're afraid she's going to die. It is always going to be a tidal wave of Taylor Swift. She's a genius.
We have hurdled the shark 20 yards ago. the thing about the Super Bowl, like, yes, I know there was the Swift effect this year, but I think that regardless of Taylor Swift being in the audience, I think the same group of people who are going to watch the Super Bowl together. You know, I know people in my life that don't watch football ever, but they, of course, watch the Super Bowl because they're watching. A lot of times it's the commercials or the halftime show. The
commercials suck this year.
Yeah, they did. They really did suck.
We're at,
except for the Jesus foot fetish one. I really liked it.
That was, no, you unironically liked it.
I really liked
liked the fact that they made Jesus a foot guy.
Yeah, like I got the feels.
He washes. Usually the commercials are the one, by the way, I texted my dad during the game and he thought my phone had been stolen. He did not believe that I was watching football. I usually love the commercials because they're usually very funny. I thought that they were, I felt insulted as a viewer watching the commercials this year because they all felt like this to me. Hey, fuckers, you like memes? Look, some memes, buy our peanuts. Like all of them felt like the most slapdash. I don't know, what are these mouth breathers like? Put that
the most in. Memorable ones were hack impressions that were hack like 20 years ago. It was like a Christopher Walken ad of like, doesn't everybody do a Christopher Walken impression? And then an Arnold ad where he has the Arnold accent. Like we've been making this joke since like before I was born.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is ancient. It was all overstuffed celebrity stuff.
I liked the donkeys one though.
Of course
it hit
you did.
Every single one of my buttons.
Jesus. Boston gets to have its voice heard.
But that was the perfect demographic for that. That
it was
commercial
fun.
To be
was,
aired.
I actually Come watched, on. There was an extended version that I watched today. That was very funny.
Yeah, they're funny.
Because Ben Affleck has always been good at self-deprecating humor. And this was him doing a gigantic self-deprecating humor. You know, they apparently sold those jumpsuits.
Really?
And they like sold out immediately. No, I mean, like this is all like Dunkin' Donuts has hit new levels of Taylor Swift levels of free.
No, they haven't.
I want
no, they
the
haven't.
Giant donut necklace. That was the part of the outfit that I was like, how do I get my hands on this? So send it to Justin's P.O. box.
Yep. Uh-huh. There we
That's
go.
That's the gift I want. But yeah, that one was cute. They also had, it wasn't in the ad, it was online, but they had Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, and Tom Brady throwing a football through a donut.
Yeah.
It was funny watching just how bad Ben Affleck was
compared
at
to
it.
Yeah.
And then Tom Brady's just like sinking all of them. It's just, I thought that one was fun. And then the Kennedy one, he kind of got in trouble with his family.
I think
that.
I missed that one. Was that before I showed up?
I think it was before he showed up. Yeah. It was early in the game.
Okay. It was the only political ad.
Yeah.
Biden didn't buy one. Trump didn't buy one.
I just figured that they weren't allowed to.
No. Trump had two in the 2020 election. Really? Of course, his campaign ran out of money in June. So maybe there was a reason for that, but
and Biden
and
forgot the deadline
was
covered up. You had to
him.
Sit at the
hey,
money by
for
Tuesday.
Real. When's the game?
And Biden didn't do the interview.
Yeah, you want to talk about that?
That's a
Let's
big
talk
deal.
About that. So Biden, this is a recent tradition.
Were the footballers were going to email or interview?
So this only goes back to Obama, but since Obama, there has been a tradition where the president will do a fairly softball interview, but not without any serious topics. So it's usually 15, 20 minutes, and it'll be during the pregame in like the last like 2 hours of the pregame.
And like the sports journalists will talk to them?
No, it'll
no,
be the
it's
news.
No, it's just a real interview.
The news people from the broadcast team that'll do it. And so
it would be like a CBS anchor, whoever the hell is famous on CBS
and
right
this
now.
This is just the president gives a football address, kind of like a junior version
of
the.
No, like it's a legit interview about, it's an interview.
It's an interview, just happens to be with the Super Bowl.
And they'll throw in a few questions at the end.
Who you rooting for?
Who are you rooting for?
Yeah, was that a catch, Mr. President? And he'll be like, I don't know. I think it might have been. Like, so everyone's done it, including Trump. Trump did it 4 years in a row. Mm-hmm. Biden did it the first year. And then last time he didn't do it because Fox was broadcasting. And so we got a little bit of a pass. Because they're like, oh, well, he didn't want to get interviewed by Brett Baer or whoever Fox would send to do it. But this year it was CBS, so
the Boomer Network.
It would have been, maybe the lady who does Face the Nation, somebody that wouldn't be hostile to him.
It would have been a softball tournament.
Yeah. And he didn't do it. And, I think he wishes he would have done it after the week he had. By the end of last week, that maybe resetting with a softball interview.
But would it have been a reset? Would he, in the interview, confuse Egypt and Mexico again? Like, there were some dangers.
There we go. And we're going to talk about that in the Patreon. But, it was, I think, a big mistake, a huge mistake. Like, that's a gigantic audience. We now know it was the largest audience. And he had a moment where he could have owned it, especially when, 7 to 10 minutes of that interview is going to be getting questions about Taylor and Travis. And he gets to say like, well, when I met Jill, I knew immediately, like, I know I don't want to rush anybody, but I knew she was the one. I was with my wife, but anyway.
it was a charm offensive opportunity.
It could have been, yes, you could have done a very sweet grandfatherly in the good way for Joe Biden kind of interview. And he decided to not do it.
I think that was a misstep. Yeah.
Unless they're so afraid of him being recorded live that
I think that's the only logical. I mean, I'm, you know, okay. Benefit of the doubt. I agree with you, but benefit of the doubt, something big as president was coming up, big enough that he did not think screen time was going to be more worthwhile than meeting with the Joint Chiefs to talk about Ukraine or something.
Well, and I also, as the congressional dish host, do want to mention that while we had this giant monoculture moment, the Senate did take that opportunity to, right before the Super Bowl, like a couple of hours before the Super Bowl, break a filibuster on $100 billion worth of war money. And then the next day, while we're all talking about the Super Bowl, voted in the middle of the night to pass that bill. So that was used as a giant distraction.
Well,
that
it was, they would have done it earlier. It was people who were opposed to the bill that strung it out over the weekend.
Still,
they would have. Yeah, trust me, they Still. Would have. They would have. Like, there were some people who wanted to, had tickets to the Super Bowl that wanted to be at the Super Bowl.
Yeah, there's reporting that the staffers were pissed off because they had to still be at work until halftime of the Super Bowl. It looks bad. It smells bad to have a body that, like, you know, the government hasn't been funding. You can't get these people to work on a weekend. In fact, after they passed the war money, they fucked off for two more weeks. They're not even coming back until, I think, the 26th. It looks bad that they're voting in the middle of the night during the Super Bowl. It looks real
early
bad.
Morning.
And
early
so if morning, there was a question maybe, about that to the president.
If we give them more power and money. This is what I always call. Maybe if we give them more power and money, they'll right the ship.
Yeah.
Incentivize them.
But one question about that to the president could have been an ugly situation too.
Well, I mean, look, if there's one thing that Joe Biden knows how to do is talk about the process of the Senate. That's what he did most of his life.
Old Joe Biden, yeah. This version of Joe Biden, I don't know if he can talk like he used to. Did you guys see Jon Stewart's back? Did you watch
I read about it. I've not seen it.
Challenge your cookies.
How was it?
Good.
Yeah, okay.
Good.
Yeah, it's nice to have
him. He went after Biden, which meant he had to do a lot of throat clearing about how Trump is also very, very bad before he did his funny stuff, which was all the jokes that were about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I hope to live in a day that the old Daily Show could exist where it didn't mean what it means now to liberal America and he didn't have to pre-argue with the people that would be mad that he's making fun of Joe Biden and he could just make fun of Joe Biden when he has the funny jokes about Joe Biden and then make fun of Donald Trump when he has the funny jokes about Donald Trump. But we don't live in that world anymore. So
I was fine.
It was good. It was good for what it was. And I was really, really happy that Stewart, you know, made a point that I've been making for a long time, which is that it's not anyone's job to clean up for politicians. Politicians are there to advertise to you. It is not your job to make excuses for them. Mm. And
I like that.
I thought that was a very, very good point made.
Yeah, you do say it all the time that the politicians are supposed to be earning our votes and convincing us to vote for them. So one of the problems with the Democratic Party not having a primary and then not having their president take this opportunity to talk to half the country during the Super Bowl is that they're not making their case anywhere. So there is a semblance, or was at least, of the Republican Party having a primary, and they were making their case for months and months and months. And so to watch the Democratic Party just like sitting on the sidelines, like they're not trying to convince
democracy
us of anything.
Is up for the election, the vote, democracy, except where the ballots and candidates are being suppressed. But in terms of the system that we have carefully rigged for the last 100 years to have a certain window, that's up for, we don't have time to debate the actual system. Just do eat your goddamn vegetables. That could be the bumper sticker for the Democratic Party. The last 8 years could be eat your fucking vegetables. And then being very surprised when America doesn't like that.
But at this point, Grandpa Joe isn't even telling us to eat the vegetables. Like, he's just silent and expecting us to do it. So it's
and then mad when you ask why he's so silent.
Yeah.
He was mad during that.
He's a grumpy old dude who can't remember shit. Like, when people get old and they get dementia, they get grumpy, and we're seeing that in Joe Biden. Like, he's just constantly looking like angry. I remember some of his angriest speeches in the Senate. He still had this like sarcastic smirk about him that is just kind of gone. Like, now he's just angry man.
Like, even in the Daily Show monologue, and I've seen this a few places where people were trying to play off, they had set up the idea that he would take the first question from Peter Ducey from Fox News, who is the requisite guy who's going to ask Joe Biden the hard question guy, right? And they set up that he would take the first question, and knowing that it was going to be about his memory, about the special counsel report, and that the pre-prepared Biden line was, "My memory's so bad, I called on you." Mm. And you know that it was set up because Biden stopped for a laugh and just kind of looked around. But because he's not, he doesn't have the charisma that he once had, and that doesn't make him demented or anything like that. It just makes him like anybody else. Like, you don't quite have the fastball. The greatest comedians of our time eventually didn't have the same timing that they once had, right? So it's not like he's extraordinarily fallen off the horse when it comes to that. But it's like, people were acting, even the Daily Show was like, "Oh, look, he got him." And it's like, really? Like, that's what we're, that's what we're hanging on? Like, you know, that's not even politician well delivered. You were,
especially
you were too
what,
angry.
What he used to be capable of. Like, his speeches, even when I didn't agree with them, were always entertaining. 100% of the time. It's all gone.
I always bought it. You know, I bought that he believed in.
I bought that he believed this.
That, that anybody with.
Never. That's my favorite Joe Bidenism, is that whenever he's talking, you know, like, "I never doubted, blah, 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 blah." It's always four nevers.
Four nevers. Yeah. I always love, I don't know, one of the right wing Twitter accounts that I follow just had one of his big thundery fire and brimstone hard on drugs legislation Senate speeches about how like 1 ounce of crack can ruin a life. You need to put these people in jail. Put them in jail. And it's just side by side with Hunter measuring, recording himself, measuring crack, smoking crack. Like, all right. Let's get into your emails. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. An email a day keeps the doctor away. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Brock Purdy's face writes, "Brock Purdy just has a Mormon face. Maybe Oswald did too."
Is Purdy a Mormon?
I don't know. Is he?
Oswald wasn't.
Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know about Purdy, but I know Oswald wasn't a Mormon.
But Purdy does look like he, you could see him on the side of the road, like on his mission.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. He's got Mormon face. I don't disagree.
What my favorite memes coming out of the Super Bowl was like, boy, imagine how pissed Purdy's going to be now that he lost and a Kennedy was advertising during the Super Bowl.
That's pretty good.
Release the Bin Laden cut says interviewing Putin is like interviewing Hitler or Bin Laden. Sure, you'll get views, but if you don't enjoy national socialism or Islamic fundamentalism, then allowing their mouthpieces to speak without challenging their ideas thoroughly, you end up just making more national socialist or Islamic fundamentalists. You can defeat ideas in the marketplace, but you must be bringing heavy artillery to that discussion, or you can just make obscene ideas acceptable to a minority. This is, of course, about the Putin interview with Tucker Carlson. Before we get into the thoughts about this, did anybody see?
Yes, I've been watching it this morning. I have maybe 20 minutes left. But yeah. Okay.
No, I have not watched
you
it.
You did not? All right. Yeah. Well,
did you watch it?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I listened to it while I was walking.
Yeah.
I didn't think that the visuals were particularly
There's nothing
important.
To see there. Yeah, I'm listening to it in the car. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was it? Did he push back very much?
I thought he asked great questions. I really did.
Anybody who called it a softball interview, I think, has never interviewed anybody before. And they have a weird idea that like MSNBC segments are actually interviews or ways that you conduct things like that. The bar for doing those kinds of interviews where you're going into hostile territory and
literally sitting in the Kremlin.
Yeah. You cannot guarantee that you and your staff are going to get out. Like that's usually you just want to ask pretty informative questions. Tucker asked about detained journalists and stuff like that. So as far as that goes, I thought it was fine. He pushed back when he thought Putin was trying to filibuster. Putin went into this weird hardcore history like lesson of
the
formation
memes I saw?
Of Russia.
Yeah. I saw some funny memes of like a picture of Tucker like when you won't shut up about Tsar Ivan the Mad or whatever it was.
Oh no, that's what I put in our group chat of the feeling when this motherfucker just brought up Yaroslav the Wise again.
Yeah.
So I thought
it was, I don't think like either one of us after listening to it is now going to apply for a Russian passport. Like, no, the email is so fucking stupid.
If anything, you know, so when I was in Serbia and Croatia, one of the things that I realized, and I'm sure Heaton, I'd be curious your opinion, and Jen, your opinion, especially in that region of the world. And I'm talking about the former Yugoslavia that obviously has ties both ethnically and politically to USSR and Russia. Ethnicity fucking matters in a real way there. Like, there's a reason why Yugoslavia has subdivided.
Like, nation is synonymous with ethnicity in most of the world. Yes. America is actually quite aberrant in using it as a civic identity.
I'm thrilled that I was raised and I live in a society for which ethnicity cannot be a thing that you murder your neighbor about. In fact, when people get murdered over ethnicity, we tend to regard it as a big deal.
As an atrocity.
And we look at it like that.
We have higher penalties for it.
We have higher penalties, right? So it's like, that is something I am happy to do. But when he goes on his 30-minute hardcore history rant, that's what he is saying. He is saying, I am fighting this on ethnic lines because the Ukrainian identity is a fake identity. It is all Russian identity and blah, blah, blah.
Or fucking Russia's a fake identity and they should be run by Kiev. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
This is my historian coming out. Like, it was Kiev and Rus, fucker.
So.
Which he says, actually.
Yeah. And what I found very interesting was, as Tucker goes through the current conflict, he says, okay, well, it sounds like you have the two areas that you felt were undeniably ethnically Russian. That right now there is no force. If you could get an agreement that Ukraine would not join NATO, could this end the war? And he goes, well, there's denazification. And that's where, to me, I understood more after listening to that, that that's where Putin gave the game away, where it's like, oh, no. There's this other thing that I'm going to say is the most important thing or the reason why the war won't end until I decide that the war ends.
But then he did also say, because Tucker, to his credit, pushed back on that. And he's like, so when you say that, like, what specifically do you want? And he just said, like, in writing that Nazis are not allowed to be a part of the Ukrainian legislature. Like,
deal.
He did give
deal.
Well, and that was the thing.
That deal right now. Yes. No Nazis in the Ukrainian legislature.
But no, literally. And he was like, this seems like something that should be easy to agree upon. So I don't.
That strikes me as pretty bullshitty.
That to me was where he does not want to be boxed into a corner in saying when he's going to end anything. He will decide denazification has occurred when he decides denazification has occurred.
Yeah.
It's more wiggly than these people, these lines, because these people, these lines, again, is what made Yugoslavia a very big country. Now many very small countries like that. That's what that has been about. And so I don't know. I thought I came away thinking that Vladimir Putin, as I had previously thought, was bit of an autocratic bully. And
he has that vibe.
I do buy that we are in a stop touching me, no you stop touching me, no you stop touching me between Russia and NATO. That everybody justifies the reason, the next fucked up thing that the other one does because the other one did something fucked up before, and nobody can agree with when it started. But that was my thought.
The takeaway for me was he said he is willing to negotiate and has been willing to negotiate. And some of the things he said about Zelensky not being willing to negotiate ring absolutely true to me because I've been paying attention. So that I found to be positive to hear him say this over and over again. Like, I'm ready for this when the other side is. I saw some reasons for optimism there. And I also found it fascinating that he said that he has not spoken to Joe Biden since the war started.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I think that would be big news.
I want to tackle the underlying idea that the listener put in here. It sounds like the synopsis here is, the marketplace of ideas is good, but you have to push back against bad ideas in the interview. Otherwise, you're just creating propaganda, something to that effect. I would agree with you that it's better to have pushback at the point of contact, but I think that ideas do not become problematic unless they're pushed back on. And I'll give you two examples from my life where I have encountered really bad shit that was not framed as bad shit, and I'm glad that I saw how dumb it was. So when I was in college, every week I'd go over to check on my great aunt Mildred after church. And I'd hang out with great aunt Mildred. And at the end of my freshman year, great aunt Mildred, age 92, goes, Andy, you like history. And I went, yeah. And she goes, well, I appreciate you coming over to my house to check on me. I got you a gift. And I went, well, thank you, Aunt Mildred. And she gave me a copy of Mein Kampf that I have to assume was entirely historical in value and nothing to do with great Aunt Mildred's views.
And then, you open the front cover. To Mildred, a good lay.
No, what was fascinating about it, I think the reason she gave it to me, it was fascinating. It was the first English printing of Mein Kampf, and it was before the war happened. So it is very bullish on Hitler. It's from an American publisher who's like, who knows what young Hitler will do? Maybe he'll fight the communists. There are some questionable comments about the Jews, but this is a regular part of European discourse. Like, it could not be rosier about Hitler. And I was like, and I read that and was like, oh, wow, this is some crazy shit. I'm now going to read Mein Kampf because this is going to be like the Necronomicon of evil shit. This is going to be like Nietzsche fucking with my head and like what crazy evil. It is the most rambling, stupid bullshit you can imagine. I read two chapters of it and was like, I can't fucking read this shit because it's such drivel. I already didn't like Hitler, mind you. Mm-hmm. I already had a pretty firm position
on Hitler. But now that he's a bad writer.
but it wasn't that uncontested idea in any, there was no point of me that was like, well, he did make a good point. No, it was stupid bullshit. And then the other example is, I couldn't go to sleep about 6 months ago. And I just listened to some podcast where they kept talking about how bad minstrel shows were. And I was like, I do kind of want to know if they were funny. Like maybe they're really racist, but maybe they were funny. So I found a minstrel show from 1940. Dumbest bullshit I've ever seen in my life. Like, I thought it would at least be funny. It wasn't. It was so fucking stupid.
Okay, dumb here again. What's a minstrel show? Because you say this, I'm hearing minstrel. No.
A minstrel show was where white people would shoe polish their faces, would put on blackface, pretend to be black people, and would do song and dance as black people. It is very.
So it's a Ted Danson, Whoopi Goldberg type of
thing.
That's
exactly what it is. Okay. It is whenever you see the bad example of blackface, they are from minstrel shows back in the day. And it was a lot of the like caricatures. It was sketch comedy, essentially.
It was the dumbest fucking skit. Like, can I give it? I'm not going to do the voices for fuck's sake, but I like what, like, this is emblematic of the whole fucking stupid enterprise.
But just say the words. Don't do the voices.
Just going to do the words.
But just in your voice.
Which if I did it, would be me making fun of white people for the record. No, somebody goes like, sufficient. Why did your mom name you Sir? Are you a knight? No, because my mom already had 8 kids and she said this one's sufficient. That it's all stupid fucking wordplay from the beginning. It's the dumbest fucking shit. But I watched this video that is not content. Like, nobody came on and go, now you're about to watch some heinous.
I don't know, man. It sounds pretty funny to me. I think now I'm in the minstrel shows.
No one.
Jen, you did not bring heavy fucking artillery. Now I'm into racist minstrel shows.
No one came on and went, you're about to see. And it was racist and it was offensive. But no one came on to preface it for me. And there wasn't like a little head at the bottom going, now this is racist, because I was able to see it was just stupid.
Yeah.
On top of all else, right? So I think information can be valuable, even if it's not being contested, just because the average reasonably intelligent person can look at it and go, I'm calling bullshit on that.
I think it's an infantilizing culture to assume that everything needs to be spoon fed to people.
Yeah.
We are smart. We are, we have the ability to do that. I want everybody to interview everybody. I want SpongeBob to interview Bin Laden.
Yeah. Like, that'd be fun.
That what a great vault tape that would be.
Putin's lines writes, Heaton's concern about the annexed areas of Ukraine that were quote unquote legally added to the Russian Federation and that Russia Putin would not be able to risk the loss of those territories without losing face. This has already happened in the case of Kherson, which was added to the Russian Federation through a sham referendum, but is now de jure and de facto under Ukrainian control. Russia has set a great number of red lines, which have already been violated one way or another.
Hey, that's good news. Thank you for telling me that. Because that's one of my concerns is that we're in an intractable situation, and it seems like it's a lot more tractable than I thought.
Trick. Yeah, and
that's what I heard.
That's why, listening to the Putin interview, I take it all seriously. I don't take everything he says literally.
Yeah.
I take the broad strokes of his story that he feels very, very frustrated with NATO and that he has these opinions about the ethnicities of the Ukrainian people. I don't take it literally that it's true and that just because he said it means that that's something that I should justify.
But it's useful to know what the man is thinking.
Yeah.
And wants our leaders to know.
Yes. I don't think that we, I don't know. Don't get defensive rights. Jen said it was reasonable for Putin to not want NATO at his border and sarcastically dismiss the fact that NATO is a defensive pact. Why? Can she explain what threat a defensive pact poses? Isn't that just that Putin has expansionist desires and wanted to strike before he couldn't anymore?
I mean, if you want to know what kind of threat your defensive pact poses, ask Libya, because we invaded and overthrew that government. Or when I say we, NATO did that. It's just like, it's not a defensive pact. It's not. It has done aggressive things. It was involved in overthrowing and regime changing Iraq. Like, it has done aggressive things. And if you were to put yourself in Russia's position and there was a so-called defensive pact consisting of Russia, Canada, Mexico, Cuba, how would we feel? So yeah, I would feel like that's aggressive, especially having watched it do aggressive things.
Jen, I'm sorry. The physics are, it is impossible for any of our missiles to be used offensively. They can only be used according to the laws of physics. If we decided to take an offensive action, it would be impossible because they're defensive bombs. And as we all know, there are very different types of bombs. There's defensive bombs and offensive bombs. We only have defensive bombs.
You sound like Netanyahu.
Yeah. I want to add something in here. When we're talking about Ukraine and we're talking about Russia, I think it's always helpful to make a distinction between moral culpability and prudence. I'm going to talk about prudence here for a minute. We all know that America's the good guy and NATO's the good guy and Russia's the bad guy. We all know this. But here's a weird thing. Russia doesn't think they're the bad guy. Russia thinks they're the good guy. In fact, most countries think that they're the good guy. It's not that China doesn't sit down and go, well, we all know we're the bad guys, right? We're the bad guys fighting the good guys. As the bad guys, as we all recognize, China, we are the bad guys. We're going to do that. No one does that. They think they're the good guys and they think that we're encroaching on them. Jen's example is, I think, very germane of if Russia formed an alliance with Canada and Mexico and said, don't worry, it's defensive. We would fucking get worked up about that. If there were missiles pointed at Buffalo, pointed at Washington, D.C. from the Canadian border and they went, but we're only defensive. We would think about that. We have really, really internalized this belief that we are the good guys and the other guys are the bad guys and that they also have that worldview and they don't have that. We can be the good guys, but just remember, that's not how they see it.
When I was in Belgrade, they still have buildings that are not repaired from when NATO bombed.
Yeah.
And we can agree or disagree on that particular conflict and that particular action, but there are parts of the world that, boy, are they not a fan of NATO. And Belgrade is certainly one of them. Comrade writes, look, Russia coming out of the USSR was corrupt as the day is long. No one in power gave a fuck about the people. Then the West, desiring a collapsed Russia, came in with both boots on Russia's neck. It took a regretful Yeltsin on the verge of a collapsed Russia with suicides through the roof, who went to the only honest nationalist he knew, Vladimir Putin, and begged him to save Russia. And he did. He revived a dying Russia with a new national pride. All the greedy oligarchs and U.S. fanboys left, and they rebuilt their country from the ground up.
You can take this one.
You know what? I can't speak to this particular plot line because I thought that Yeltsin just brought in like an old KGB guy that he thought would be a good sidekick. I don't, this sort of Russian hagiography I'm unfamiliar with. What I will say where I can intersect with the listener a little bit on is George Kennan, one of the foremost architects of the Cold War that no one would accuse of being a limp-wristed peacenik that was very much in favor of containment strategy with Vietnam and everything else, much of which we would disagree with today. George Kennan, when the Soviet Union collapsed, went and we started adding or we invited other countries to join NATO. He went, what are you doing? Our problem wasn't with Russia. Our problem was with the communist Soviet regime. And they just had a large peaceful revolution that got rid of that regime that we had a problem with. We don't have a problem with the Russian people. We don't have a problem with the nation of Russia. We had a problem with communism. We had a problem with totalitarianism. That's gone away. Let's figure out how to reproach. Let's figure out how to make friends. And I think we missed a very big opportunity to do that. It would have been better if we'd figured out how to do some kind of Marshall Plan with Russia when it fell apart in order to make them a more liberal democracy instead of the oligarchic authoritarian state they've turned into.
No, they've rebuilt with national pride. I think you missed that part of the email.
You know, something that Russia is doing that I find to be kind of a corollary in the United States that bothers me on multiple levels. The Soviet Union was very, very militant atheist, blew up churches, tortured priests, things like that. And in the wake of the Soviet Union, as the Russian Federation came in, more and more people identify as Russian Orthodox, but it doesn't correspond with attendance. It doesn't seem to actually be a reflection of spiritual awakening. It's because the Russian Orthodox Church is increasingly viewed as a proxy for the Russian nationalism. And
yeah,
I don't like that. And I think that's happening to some extent here in the United States, where a lot of people are identifying as something because it's a proxy for being Republican or a proxy for being Democrat. And I think they've got that at a much greater and more ominous degree.
Ukrainian agency check writes, I'm really tired of y'all talking about the Ukrainians like they got zero agency in this. The U.S. is not making them fight. We aren't prolonging the conflict and causing people to die by supplying the Ukrainians. Unless by that you mean that the Ukrainians should just lie down and be conquered, and anything that stops that is prolonging the conflict. The Ukrainians have agency here. They do have a right to self-determination, and we should be helping them fight Putin for as long as they want. You don't get to decide for them what their independence isn't a cause worth fighting for. They are perfectly capable of deciding it isn't worth the cost anymore and ceding territory to Putin in exchange for peace if they wanted to do so. Unless they do that, we should stand behind them.
Ukrainian agency.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand the sentiment here, but I think it's really naive to think that at this point the Ukrainian government is in any way independent, or that it has been since 2014. We are funding...
Well, their payroll isn't now.
No, we're paying for the entire government. Yeah. Every single one of their tax dollars goes towards weapons. And when you talk about Ukrainian agency of the people there, like this is just what they want, they're now at the point that Ukrainian men don't have a choice. They are being drafted to fight. This is not an all-volunteer situation. And if they wanted to change their leadership, they have no democratic way to do that because their elections have been officially canceled. So when you talk about Ukrainian agency, exactly what way are they supposed to change course if they don't get to change course with elections? So with us paying to the extent that we are, with our State Department telling Congress straight up that the plan is to prolong the war, to say that we should just, you know, fund the Ukrainians and do what the Ukrainians want, it's not practical. It's just not practical. We are pulling the strings here. We are funding the entire thing. We are in charge of what is happening in Ukraine. Very
one of the obvious arguments I heard over the last week was, you know, and you have pointed out not only on Congressional Dish, but on this show, that it is the stated goal of the United States government to keep this war, however you define Ukrainian agency, but it is in our interest to make sure that the war continues to go because we want to deplete Russian forces. We want to, make sure that they are hobbled. And I don't know whether or not this backs up with stuff that you've heard, or it was just the commentator that I was listening to, but the stat was that 90% of the Russian military has been on some level either degraded or hobbled or whatever. And so the argument would be like, well, what do we want? What? 95, 98, like 90% of the Russian military being, you know, worse than it was before. Look, if you're looking for bang for the buck, feels like we got it. How much longer are we going to squeeze the orange here?
So I don't know about that stat, but what seemed clear to me having watched that hearing is that the State Department wants to bankrupt Russia. It's more about the money than the bodies. So I don't know the state of the American military or the Russian military. It was kind of concerning how little of a discussion there was about that. It was all about economics. Like they want also, Russia to continue to spend their money on this.
I don't trust the State Department when it comes to the economics argument.
No.
I do not find them to be particularly economically literate.
No.
The listener writes, I'm really tired of hearing you all talk about the Ukrainians as if they have zero agency in this. I am very tired of having to explain that I am talking about what America does and not what Ukraine does. Ukraine's a sovereign country. They can do what they want. I support their right to do what they want. They are an autonomous sovereign country. I don't think we should be pushing them around or telling them what to do. Nor am I claiming to do that. What I am saying is, if it's American tax dollars, every fucking American gets to have an opinion on that. If it's American missiles, every fucking American gets to have an opinion on that. So I am concerning myself not with what Ukraine is doing, but what with America is doing. And I can have an opinion on that because it's what America is doing. So I'm concerned with America and what we're doing. And I don't think that we have to write blank checks. And I don't think we have to automatically defend people. It might be a good idea, but I don't think it should be automatic. And I think it's always good to have debate about this kind of thing.
And I definitely don't think it should be done with no debate in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Well, again, the funny part about that is that they would have done it on Friday if the Rand Pauls of the world weren't dragging it out longer than as long as they wanted to, because they wanted to draw more attention to
they
it.
They wanted to go on vacation. That's what they wanted. They could have pushed this off until Monday or Tuesday, but they wanted to go home for 2 weeks.
I just thought it was so funny that as soon as the border thing went down, it was worth it for the border thing to go down just to see how much it was a mask off moment where they were like, okay, well, whatever. We tried. We tried with whatever this border thing was. Like, yeah. We're just going to pass it clean. Who cares? Whatever. Here's the 91 billion that's going to go out. 98 billion. Oh, look at that. Inflation.
But who's counting?
Thanks, Biden. Expectation Game writes, I'm just curious what would be the most surprising but realistically possible election outcome for 2024 for each of you. Love the pod. Please don't let the clash of your individual fan bases deter you or get under your skin. You each bring very distinct kinds of fans to this pod, and they're going to sometimes really struggle with how to handle opposing viewpoints. Well, Expectation Game, thank you for writing in. Of course, the Congressional Dish and Political Orphanage fans are very immature, and they don't handle each other very well. PX3 fans, of course, perfect angels that just process everything like little truth robots that I've trained them to be.
Yeah, to the point that I can't even go in your Discord because they're so mean.
Thank you, listener. This was a kind thing to say. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
What do you have? What are the most surprising election outcomes?
Okay. This is my surprising election outcome. I'm not rooting for this, by the way. I'm just saying possibilities that can happen. The Economist ran an article a month ago where they looked at the actuarial tables for somebody with the health and age of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And what they came up with was that there is a 75% chance both men would be able to serve out their term over 4 years were they elected. I'm going to infer that means that there's a 25% chance that they would die at some point over the next 4 years. And if you combine those two events simultaneously, you get a probability of 6.25% that both men would die. So if we're talking possible but improbable things which could occur between now and the election day, I would say that both major candidates end up leaving for health reasons and are replaced. It's unlikely, but it's possible.
Jen?
I don't know. This question is catching me at a really hopeless time. I honestly don't know how to answer it. I don't know what would surprise me at this point. What would surprise me at this point is anything that's not Trump and Biden. I don't know. I can't answer this question. I don't know.
Game Check-In writes, has he never played Cities Skylines?
I have not. I'm curious to see what it is. I used to play SimCity when I was in high school, but I don't think I've played that since college. It's been a long time.
An internet lawyer brings us on home. Every pro bono client that I have had that was incarcerated wanted to be transferred to a private prison. Make that what you will.
Interesting.
We're Not Wrong is the production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Mr. Heaton, headmaster of the Political Orphanage. What's going on?
I am very excited because this week I had on Alain Bertaud for the second time. Alain Bertaud is a legendary urbanist. If you know anybody involved in urban planning or architecture or who's done anything with the urbanist school at NYU. He is a very, very well-known name. He's been a giant in that field for 50 years. I had him on last year when I did City Week, specifically talking about urban planning. Really, really liked the guy. He's also adorable, by the way. He looks like Jerry Lewis, and he wears an ascot, and he has these giant fighter pilot-sized headphones that he's wearing. So he looks like Jerry Lewis, like, fighting in World War I. He's adorable. He's from France. So he has a French accent. He's a really nice guy. I had him on last year, and listeners wrote in, and they were like, just fucking interview him about him. Like, you spent an hour talking about, like, urban planning and zoning and shit. And it was interesting. But, like, the guy worked, like, he literally worked in the USSR, like, as an urbanist. Like, the Soviets hired him to come fix their cities. He worked in Algeria. He's worked in communist China, I think, during Mao. Like, he's done all these things. So I called him and was like, hey, man, I would really just love to talk to you about what you've done. And we ended up talking about his career and how incentives affect things would be kind of the broad thesis. So like where he was talking about when he was working in the Soviet Union, that because they had, you know, for lack of a better term, a monopolistic vertical integrated economy, he would have to order five times as many windows for all of his projects than he needed, because he knew that because they were only looking at the quota, they would make the windows about 80% thinner than a standard window. That way the guy at the factory could go, we got all the windows done on time, and then they'd all break. So he had to overorder all of them. And then, like, when he would hang out with his architect buddies in Cuba, they would ask him questions like, when you buy a laptop, how many backup laptops do you have to buy? Like, we usually buy three or four laptops because we know only one of them will work. And Alain Bertaud's like, we just buy one laptop. They usually work in America. And then we got talking about France, which I was fascinated by, where he was talking to me about how both the massive emphasis on public funding of culture and kind of some of the weird long tail effects of that. So according to Alain, you cannot put books on sale in France without permission of the government, because that is considered unfair to the other booksellers. It's unfair to allow you to undercut their sales, which struck me as the most stupid economic bullshit on stilts I've ever heard in my life. He's also lived in New York for a while, so that might be outdated information. Anyway, a delightful legendary urbanist, Alain Bertaud, is on the Political Orphanage this week. It's a fun interview.
Look at that. Jen, is there any Congressional Dish archive episode that people might listening to?
So I'm back to work. I'm researching, doing all kinds of stuff, but I actually put something on the Congressional Dish Patreon. Ooh. And I made it free. It has nothing to do with Congress. It's actually the most personal episode of anything I've ever recorded. But I noticed, especially since we started talking about it on this show, and also just in my personal life, once I started telling people that I wasn't drinking, every once in a while I would get someone that would come up to me or email me and have questions. And especially the in-person ones, I just got the vibe that they wanted to know more for their own personal reasons. And instead of me telling the story over and over again and not really knowing what they're asking, I decided that I would record an episode and just tell all of it. How I stopped, why I started to begin with, just all of it, so that if it can help anyone else, it's out there. Because one of the things that helped me quit was other people's stories. And even though I know people in my personal life that have quit, like, I didn't want to talk to them about it. It was really the anonymity of celebrity stories on the internet that helped me through this. So I figured that the anonymity of hearing mine might help other people. So I put that up on the Congressional Dish Patreon. It's a free episode. You can go and check that out. And I've actually gotten so much amazing feedback since that. People that told me that I convinced them to continue their dry Januaries. And so I'm really glad I did it, but it was absolutely terrifying. And it's available if anyone wants to hear that story.
Well, that sounds great.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And you guys were in it, all positive ways, of course.
Okay, good.
But
good.
Yeah.
Good. PX3, what'd we do? Evan Scrimshaw of The Lines, political betting expert. He came on Wednesday and we discussed the electoral fallout of some of the Joe Biden stuff and got into a little bit of what we're going to talk about in the Patreon about the feasibility of replacing Joe Biden and the futile idea of replacing Joe Biden. And then we got into a little bit of the Senate map and a little bit of New York 3, which wound up going back to the Democrats. That was the Santos seat in the special election. So, yeah,
it's my understanding that American citizens cannot legally bet on our own elections.
Yes.
So is it that you go through a European market to do it, or is it that Europeans are doing the betting?
So you can bet into a market, so you can technically make money, like predict it. You can bet on predict it, and that has markets for political stuff. But you're essentially buying kind of like fake shares.
Got it.
In an outcome.
This is like how in Indian casinos in Oklahoma for a while, it all had to be through bingo. So you could play blackjack, but it had to be on a ball. Like it's
yes.
So, okay. So you can gamble. You just have to add a step. Got it.
Thank you. I mean, you just can't go to Vegas and say, here's $500. I want to take a Trump.
You had a hand wave.
Trump yeah. plus 10. Like you can't do that and parlay it with the Senate map or anything like that.
Okay. That's so fun. You should be able to do that.
I know stocks better than I know gambling, though. I mean, like just in terms of like, oh, I'm buying stock at X versus how odds work. I don't know how odds work.
Scrimshaw, he had come on the show and been very, very bullish on Nikki Haley coming in second in Iowa. And then when we were in Iowa and it was a frozen fucking hellscape.
Negative 18, I think was where
we were. And we were skidding everywhere. We would, we drove and it was like everywhere was the Walking Dead. You would have thought it was like a post-apocalyptic. We literally were on our way to the live show and we just saw a car with no one in it. Its hazard lights on, slowly skidding down a hill. And so I DM'd Scrimshaw and I'm like, hey, just so you know, I'm on the ground here. I think it's going to be a low turnout election. Like, this is not cold. This is face of the moon cold. And if it's low turnout, I think it'll be DeSantis second, Nikki third. And that apparently scared him enough that he sold out of, because it's not betting. He didn't bet on Nikki being second. He bought into shares of that. So at any moment, you can sell out of your position like it were a stock. It was high, so we sold out, made money, and was able to do that because I gave him the inside tip of, like, that it was the face of Mars.
I might get into this because, like, I know enough about economics to know I shouldn't pick stocks. Like, yeah. I do not know enough. Like, I don't know enough about the microchip industry to know whether Nvidia is a good bet.
Just,
like,
do what Nancy Pelosi does. You'll make money.
Yeah. Well, no, you know what? Weirdly, the it turns out Congress people are not good at picking stocks.
No.
Corrupt
not Congress
people.
Nancy is.
Not Congress people. Nancy.
I got it. Nancy. Yeah.
Follow that Nvidia portfolio. Stock. Holy shit. She's made like, I think something like 8 times her congressional salary in the last couple
alert,
months.
Spoiler alert, chips.
Yeah.
Like Sam Altman but I'm thinking $7 billion.
But I'm thinking get an ETF as opposed to NVIDIA because, like, I don't know if there's competitors. My point is I don't know what the landscape looks like or the mechanisms, whereas, like, I can go to New Hampshire and go, everybody I'm talking to is just pulling for Dean Phillips or whatever the fuck the thing is, right? Whereas, like, there might be special knowledge that we're able to get.
I would love if you became a predicted degenerate.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
That would be fun.
That'd be amazing. What an arc for Heaton. Anyway, that's on PX3, and we're going to interview a dude who is a Democratic super PAC funder. So that'll be fun. But till next time, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young for Andrew Heaton and Jen Briney. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.